Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with us today is John Lechner. Now, John is a journalist and an independent researcher and consultant to NGOs and other institutions working in Africa. He holds a master's degree in foreign service from Georgetown University. He speaks Russian, French, Turkish, and a whole bunch more languages. His reporting has been featured in the New York Times, The Atlantic. The Atlantic is big news this week. The Washington Post and the BBC, and published in Foreign Policy, Lawfare, and War on the Rocks. The book that we're talking about today is Death is Our Business, Russian Mercenaries and the New Era of Private Warfare. Welcome to Writer's Voices, John.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, why did you want to write a book about this subject?
Well, it's a great question. I think you alluded to it earlier. I think my greatest passion in life is actually languages. I mean, language in all form, in all forms. But ever since I was a little kid, I was always fascinated by foreign languages and have always been trying to learn as many languages as possible. That first took me to Russia, where I lived for a little while before going to college. I was a Russian studies major. And then, like a lot of very creative people, I decided to go work in finance for 7 years trying to kind of fit a square peg into a round hole. And then eventually I realized that kind of the vehicle or the way that I could more closely match what I do for work with what I read in my free time was to become a writer and a journalist. And so I had been spending a bit more time in Africa as well. And so when there were first reports of Russian mercenaries showing up in the Central African Republic around 2018, this to me was sort of just a confluence of my major interests of Russia, Russian studies, and African languages and society. And so I first showed up in 2019 because I just wanted to cover it and understand what happens when, you know, these two very kind of disparate groups, societies come together, and how do they interact, adapt or not adapt to each other.
Okay, so these are kind of the hot spots of the world that you write about and that you go to and you spend time in, and so the book covers a lot of things that are happening in Africa, but also the Middle East, which is partly Africa, partly Asia, I guess, and then Eastern Europe as well, Ukraine. And when did you decide, like, when did you start working on this book? When did you say, I'm going to write a book about this?
Probably I first started showing up in the Central African Republic, where these Russian mercenaries were operating, in 2019. I went to grad school and continued to travel to the Central African Republic while on vacation, I guess, from grad school. I mean, this was also during the height of COVID as well. And then once I got out, I worked for a little bit of time, for the government. And then I knew that there was a book to be written about this subject, and so I left that job basically I think New Year's Eve in 2021, and so in 2022 I set out just to be kind of an independent journalist with the idea of writing. I didn't have like a fully formed what exactly the book was going to be, but I knew that there was a book to be written about it, and I had to spend a lot more time in the field. And so This has definitely been now a 3-year project for sure.
And of course, you've published a lot of articles on these subjects during that time. I imagine that helps put food on the table and keeps things going. Yeah.
There's beautiful, when you're an independent journalist and writer, the beauty is you can research whatever it is that you want to research. The downside is that cash flow can often be sporadic, to say the least.
So as I was reading through this book, I feel like there's kind of three or four, you could get three or four books out of this because you talk about kind of the history of mercenaries, which is could be a whole topic in and of itself. And where how we've gotten to where we are now. You write about the Africa, the what happened when the colonial powers get overthrown, and what's happening in Africa and how the Russians are getting involved in that. That could be a whole book by itself. And then Ukraine could be a whole book by itself. And also, you talk to actual mercenaries and follow kind of their trajectory, and that could be a whole book by itself. Not to mention the things happening in the Middle East that you write about as well. So how do you harness all of that
I mean,
into
it was, I think you could, I think what comes off, and this is why it's so fun to be on this show, because we can talk about I wanted this book to be about mercenaries, obviously, and about Wagner, but I also wanted it. I, as a writer myself, I had a lot of ambition for the book, and I wanted it to be many things. And like you said, the book is many things. It is part myself being in these places and interviewing these mercenaries and my experience doing it. It is also, and I think most crucially, a book that gives readers a history of some of these places that they might not normally be exposed to, the Central African Republic, for example. And I think that's for a number of reasons. I think that these places are interesting in and of themselves, whether Wagner was there or not. But Wagner, and for the listeners, Wagner was first in eastern Ukraine in 2014, and then in Syria, and then in Sudan, Central African Republic, Madagascar, Mozambique briefly, Libya, Mali, and the Sahel. These are all, as you mentioned before, some of the world's greatest hotspots for conflict that produce a large proportion of the refugees the refugee population in the world today. And so these Russian mercenaries, they were never the cause of these conflicts. They were a symptom of it. And I think it was very important to place them within the overall ecosystem of these conflicts. And I hope what folks learn is not only the history of Wagner, but also the history of the conflict in Sudan, in the Sahel, in Libya. And you meet these other, in many cases, more powerful armed actors on the ground than the Russian mercenaries themselves. And so, but from a writerly perspective, the ambitious aspect of it is how do you tie these things together for a reader in a chronological narrative, because it's for a general audience. It's not an academic book where I can just address themes and that sort of thing. And how do I tie it together in a way that moves the story forward while also kind of like adding all of those little details on as we go.
Right. And so you basically focusing on the Wagner army, is sort of the through line through this. So let's talk about the Wagner Group a little bit, because that is kind of the private military company that is possibly the best known because of what they did marching on Moscow. And that actually is a fairly small part of this book. Well, tell us about that, about how Wagner got started and how it ended.
Yeah. So, and this will also be a little, I think, the section from which I'll read about the beginning of Wagner, but we have to go back to the 2014 and the Kremlin's annexation of Crimea during the Maidan Revolution in Ukraine. And it was during that time that, the then president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, made kind of a split second reversal of a decision of moving away from signing an agreement with the European Union and moving closer to the West to reneging on that and signing an agreement with Russia for Russia's own economic union. And many Ukrainians across the country rose up and ultimately overthrew Yanukovych's government. During this kind of crazy revolutionary moment where no one really knows what's going on, the Kremlin makes the decision that they're going to annex the peninsula of Crimea. They want to do it for a number of reasons, not least of which is the peninsula is host to Russia's Black Sea Fleet. It's the only warm water port. And Russia had, you know, a series of longstanding leases, you know, to keep it there. But the decision was made, we're going to take Crimea. And to do so, they relied on special forces, but also nationalist, Russian chauvinist, various groups, right-wing groups show up and provide a bit of muscle and also to lend sort of a degree of kind of like local legitimacy that these guys aren't in fatigues and things along those lines. And so a lot of these folks show up, Cossacks, there are some Serbs who show up, and various Russian nationalists who I detail in the book, and many of them are actually opposed to Putin's government himself, but they're very much for annexing Crimea. And so they're to the right of Putin. And the annexation basically goes without a hitch, and the Kremlin thinks, okay, you know, done and dusted, all of these people can go home. But again, in eastern Ukraine, there is also at the same time a counter Maidan movement. These are people in the region of Donbass. Many of them have much stronger economic ties, you know, through coal mining to Russia. And so they start taking over buildings as well. And they think that the Russian state is going to come to their aid, as they believe it came to the aid of the Russians in Crimea. And this puts Putin in a difficult situation because he only recently had faced protests against his own return to the presidency in Moscow. And many of those protesting were actually from very nationalistic right-wing circles. And those are the folks that he feared much more than kind of the liberals like Navalny at the time. And so he was put in a tough spot. The Kremlin didn't want to annex more Ukrainian territory and risk a full-scale war with Ukraine or more sanctions, more isolation, but they couldn't be seen as kind of letting these separatists, pro-Russian separatists, hang out to dry. And so they looked for ways to both support and not support in a very ad hoc way. And one of the ways that they did it was by turning to, you know, contractors or mercenaries who were basically Russian military veterans who had worked for some PMCs previously to go provide the support. And this brought together a man, Yevgeny Prigozhin, who was an ex-con who managed to work his way up to becoming the contractor for providing the military with meals in Russian schools, which earned him the nickname Putin Chef. And a guy, Dmitry Utkin, who was a former officer in Russian military intelligence. And Prigozhin was sort of the financial sponsor, offering also kind of political cover, while Utkin provided sort of the actual military, the men and the tactics and strategy. And so these guys go into Luhansk, one of the separatist cities, in 2014. And I'll be reading a section from one of the Serbs who actually goes and joins them around that time. But so from there, you know, they support the separatists. They help the Russian state take out some of the separatists who were kind of wayward separatists during the Minsk ceasefire agreement, those who didn't want to agree to a ceasefire. Mm-hmm. And then as things calm down in Ukraine, Prigozhin lobbies very hard to get his men that he now has at his disposal into Syria. Russia intervenes in Syria overtly in 2015. There was nothing covert about it. And Prigozhin was constantly lobbying and getting his men kicked out, actually, of the mission. But ultimately, they played a large role on the ground in Russia's anti-ISIS campaign. The readers will then become familiar with a big gamble that Prigozhin took that put him in direct confrontation with the U.S. Special Forces that led to a big routing. And then from there, I mean, you really see, I think, in the book that the degree to which Prigozhin's own ambition was critical to Wagner's success. And so he has a lot of guys basically doing business development and looking at various countries in Africa where they could sell their services. And they first arrive in Sudan, providing training in exchange for mineral concessions in 2017. Then the Central African Republic in 2018, then Libya as well in 2018, where they eventually help or support General Khalifa Haftar as he tries to take the capital of Tripoli, and then ultimately as well in the Sahel in Mali, where they're contracted to fight against various jihadist groups, all of which before they ultimately are... Well, at first they're excluded, and then Prigozhin manages to get his guys into Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. And this is really when Wagner becomes, and Prigozhin becomes sort of a worldwide name. The Kremlin initially was having little success in Ukraine. Prigozhin's men, who were very experienced, deliver some victories, and then Prigozhin gets the exclusive permission to recruit convicts from Russia's prison system. He ultimately recruits up to 50,000, and he promises that he'll take the city of Bakhmut from Ukraine. And the way that he does it is by using human waves of these convicts who leap out of the trenches and storm the Ukrainian positions. But as you can imagine, with someone of this type of ambition, someone this kind of uncouth, Prigozhin makes a lot of enemies within Putin's inner circle as well, and especially in Ukraine, they tried to check him, not least of which is Minister of Defense Sergei Shoigu. And so Prigozhin has promised victory in Bakhmut to Putin. Meanwhile, the Ministry of Defense cuts him off of his means to do so. So he loses the right to recruit the convicts. The Ministry of Defense takes over that program. They continue to do so, but he no longer can. And so Prigozhin goes increasingly public in his spat with the Ministry of Defense. And ultimately, when the Ministry of Defense gets permission from the Kremlin to basically take Prigozhin's guys away from him, and this is now a force that he recognizes makes him political in Russia, he decides to mutiny and ultimately marches on Moscow.
And how many soldiers marched on Moscow? What was the size of the? And did he?
We don't
did
have
he,
like a very.
Did he really think he was going to succeed?
I mean, this is always a great question. We don't know the exact number of people who marched. He probably had maybe 10 to 20,000 people under him at that time, most likely, because I mean, half of the 50,000 people that were recruited as convicts were killed.
Half?
And yeah. And so I think at the time what he recognized, and this was a moment where he's come out of the shadows. He was always an incredibly ambitious, narcissistic, egomaniacal person. And I think when he recognized that the Ministry of Defense was going to take these forces away from him, that it meant at the very least obscurity and perhaps in the longer term his ultimate demise. And I don't think that he was constitutionally at that time capable. This was a moment when the whole world knew his name, CNN, New York Times, everybody was reaching out to him every day for comments. He was the face of the war itself. I don't think he was constitutionally capable of just retiring to a log cabin in Siberia and chopping wood. And in his mind, it was a choice between himself and the Minister of Defense, Sergei Shoigu, and the mutiny was an effort to capture and kill the Minister of Defense. And in sort of a very kind of Russian prison mentality, Prigozhin decided he would make the choice easier for Putin by capturing and killing Shoigu so that he didn't have to make a decision. And so that was the logic.
So he wasn't actually mutinying against Putin.
No, I think what scared him and what ultimately caused him to call it off was, as they were marching into Moscow, increasingly into kind of empty space before getting to Moscow, the effort to capture and kill the Minister of Defense was becoming potentially an overthrow of Putin himself. Mm. And he was constantly trying to send messages that he was not trying to overthrow the government or overthrow Putin. He was just going after these guys. But, you know, events are getting away from him. And it seems increasing that accidentally he could be causing the overthrow itself. And I think that's ultimately what led him to call it off. It's a bit like there's a great German short story from the 18th century by Michael Kohlhaas, by von Kleist, where essentially this peasant accidentally causes a revolt by basically trying to get justice from the baron who abuses his horses, and he just wants to get justice from the baron. But ultimately, the series of events coalesce, and he's now leading a revolt against the state almost accidentally. And I think, in a way, that was sort of the issue that he was facing.
Wow. So he actually called it off. What happened to the men? Were they rounded up? Did they go back to their homes? Did they go back?
I think kind of readers or listeners are probably familiar. you know, this was probably the one moment where he shouldn't. He was always a big gambler. He had an insane risk tolerance. He could have, he should have probably doubled down at that moment instead of calling it off. And that's kind of ultimately what sealed his fate. We don't know what would happen if he could have reached Moscow or not. At the very least, it would have been a very destabilizing. But ultimately, his fate and the fate of some other kind of top Wagner figures was sealed. They were killed when a bomb exploded in their private plane 3 months later. For the rest of the people in Wagner, the decision was made sort of that they were led astray by Prigozhin. The convicts themselves spent probably, I mean, at least a number of weeks sort of in these kind of guarded dormitories before they like were eventually allowed to go home. And then the regular Wagner fighters also kind of escaped punishment, and they have gone on to join different units or are trying to form sort of their own units themselves.
So, John, when you were watching this unfold, the march on Moscow, who were you hoping would win?
Oh, man. Well, from a book perspective, I guess Prigozhin, because I had already signed the contract. So, and it was a tough thing to sell, by the way, because, I mean, at the time when I was pitching it, I mean, Wagner was mostly in Africa and people were like, oh, this is kind of interesting, but it's tough to sell books about Africa, especially to an American audience, even if there are Russian mercenaries. And it's even tough to sell a book about Russia if it's not about Putin. And, you know, this is very much about other Russians in Russia who are also very powerful, like Prigozhin. But I was taken aback by it. My publisher was taken aback by it because they were like, wait a minute, we bought the book for this thing. So, you know, I think that the answer to that question is like, who would have been better for Russia? It's very, there's a section in the book where the Americans were also trying to consider who would be better.
Or who would be worse.
or who would be worse.
Yeah. For the world.
Yeah. Yes. And I think it would have, they're both equally brutal men. There might have been, you know, kind of more specifically, if he had won or if he had toppled Putin, you might have seen, he might have been more open, strangely enough, to enter into negotiations with Ukraine fairly quickly, because as you saw in the book, as he was trying to outmaneuver his rivals in the Ministry of Defense, he really took to social media and was trying to win over the public. And in order to do so, he gave very frank reasons for why Russia invaded Ukraine, and very much they were much more about kind of the efforts to enrich the elite. Of course, he also was a part of that, and he left out, you know, his own efforts to do so. So he might have been more open to kind of certain foreign policy things, but I'm not sure that it would have been a very stable situation either.
Right. Now, so the Wagner group has just disbanded completely after that, or is there still some remnant of it?
There is still remnants of it in like the Central African Republic, parts in Mali as well. There are kind of various units that are trying to reform that leverage the brand and the kind of within this world of mercenarism, right, which brings with it its own culture, its own sort of branding and things along those lines. There are commanders who fought within Wagner who are famous and are now trying to leverage that to create their own units as well, and leveraging the brand. And so there's Wagner Legion, Wagner Istria, these various other kind of entities that are forming.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is John Lechner, author of Death Is Our Business, Russian Mercenaries, and the New Era of Private Warfare. So, Russia's not the only place where you find mercenaries coming from. And in fact, when it all started, didn't they kind of blame it on the US? That they were just doing what we were doing.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's why it was important to set it out in the book that, the Russian version of mercenarism is inextricable from the larger global trend in the privatization of warfare. And within those global trends, the US played an incredibly large role in sparking kind of a new phase of outsourcing many aspects of warfare to contractors, especially under the Bush Jr. administration after the September 11th attacks, where for the US to prosecute the war on terror as it wanted to do, which was a multi-front, I mean, multi-front war, but I mean, especially in the 2000s, full-scale war in both Afghanistan and Iraq, in order to put or to just logistically be capable of doing it, they had to rely on contractors to do so. And if they didn't, then the US would have needed a military draft in order to have that many people on the ground. And so, I mean, and it provided a number of advantages. One was that you don't have to resort to a draft, which usually requires a higher degree of buy-in from voters, right? If there's a potential draft, it lowers the political costs because you don't have to report the deaths of contractors, and so more contractors died in Afghanistan than U.S. troops, and so it lowers sort of the political costs of things showing up on the news, and it allows you to augment the forces so that they could have actually what was, even when we had 100,000 people troops in Iraq, the real number of people who were there was much, much, much higher. And so it allowed for also a lighter footprint as well.
So, John, why don't you read a little bit from Death Is Our Business?
Sure. So I thought I would pick out this section because we were talking about the beginning of Wagner in Luhansk in 2014. And this little section is follows one of the early Wagner fighters that I spoke with, a guy who I met actually in Serbia and interviewed him, and he's a Serb. And for the purposes of this book, we call him Bronco. And so I'll start off with this section here. So Bronco was a member of Serbian Special Forces who had fought in Bosnia and Kosovo. In 2014, he arrived in Luhansk on the invitation of his friend Radomir Pochuca, a commander in the Serbian police. When Bronco saw that the 25 men before him had just three rifles, he left for another group, which brought him to a hostel in Luhansk. His new unit was not the only one in the hostel. Going out each day, Bronco peeked into a few rooms along the corridor where serious-looking men pored over maps. He had no clue who these men were, of course, but they would nod and greet each other cordially in the hallway. On a mission in November 2014, Bronco was on the front when an ordnance exploded nearby. He was transported to the hospital in Luhansk, where one afternoon, to his surprise, a man walked up to his bed. The 52-year-old retired colonel, with gray bangs combed straight down his forehead, typical Russian style, introduced himself as Andrei Nikolaevich. "We heard you're good," Andrei Nikolaevich told Bronco, "and that you need some money." "That's true," said Bronco. He handed him $450, then scribbled something on a piece of paper. "Go to this address in Russia and tell him that Andrei Nikolaevich sent you." After Bronco was released from the hospital, he prepared to go to Molkino. Another friend from the Special Forces, Lucky, had been invited too, along with one other Serb, Davor Savicic. Savicic, a Bosnian Serb, claimed to be a paramilitary veteran. Before popping up in Luhansk, he had been on the run from Montenegrin police after someone owing him 15,000 euros died mysteriously in a bomb blast. Zhivkovic recruited him to Luhansk, where Savicic proved he could burn bridges as easily as cars. After he drunkenly fell out of a truck, Zhivkovic kicked him out of his brigade. Others say Savicic left after a fight over who would command the unit. Savicic wandered Luhansk looking for a contract and eventually stumbled upon Andrei Nikolaevich in the same unassuming way Bronco did. Savicic wanted to join Bronco and Lucky, but Bronco felt his story didn't add up. He put a gun to Savicic's head. Davor began crying, saying he wasn't a spy, that he really was in the military and so on. And Lucky defended him too, saying he was a good guy. So Bronco put his gun away and the three headed to Molkino. When they arrived at the base, Bronco told the guards he was sent by Andrei Nikolaevich. As he found out later, Andrei Nikolaevich was Andrei Nikolaevich Troshev, call sign Sidoy, or Gray Hair. Troshev was the managing director of Prigozhin and Utkin's organization, or as insiders only called it, the company. After spending time training and shooting, Bronco was sent back to Luhansk. Once there, he was shocked how much money was flying around. Troshev, Utkin, even Radobor, everyone was lining their pockets, he said. The most common scheme was to over-invoice the Russian military. Commanders told the Ministry of Defense they had 200 men on the payroll. Really, they had 150 men and pocketed the extra salaries. Commanders over-invoiced for equipment as well. It was too much money, Bronco felt. Wagner could have been a great thing if there wasn't so much money flying around. Utkin and Prigozhin's team weren't the only ones making money in Donbass. Local militia commanders also turned to racketeering. The war was becoming one large asset grab. On January 1st, 2015, local separatist commander Alexander Batman Bednov was ambushed outside Luhansk by men with automatic weapons and grenade launchers. The commander, along with six of his men, was killed. The story was that the Ukrainians had carried out an assassination deep in enemy territory, but few believed it. The Minsk peace process was well underway, and Batman was a popular figure who had made his opposition to Minsk very apparent. Rumors spread that the leader of the LNR, the Luhansk People's Republic, Igor Plotnitsky, had given the order to liquidate independent commanders. A few months after Batman's car was sprayed with bullets, a vehicle carrying the commander Alexei Mozgovoy, Vorobyov's local partner, blew up. Then local Cossack commander Pavel Dromov, who was critical of LNR leadership, died when his car exploded on the way to his own wedding. By this point, Igor Sirelkov-Girkin had resigned from his post, a move likely demanded by Moscow given his role in the death of 298 civilians on Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. Whether it was LNR authorities or the Russian military, it seemed there was an effort to bring the separatist militias into one centralized structure. Russian officials wanted to stabilize the war in Donbass. While the first Minsk agreement never held, intense diplomatic negotiations were taking place for a second. and the Russian military began deploying more unmarked troops or little green men to seize territory before the front line froze. The Baltseve, wedged between the borders of the DNR and the LNR with railroad lines that connected the two, was an important pocket of Ukrainian resistance. Separatist militias, volunteers, and mercenaries converged on the town in what would become the last major battle in the war. I think I'll stop there.
Wow. So one thing about the annexation of Crimea, it seems like after it was done, the world kind of forgot about it. And
yes.
It's like, how and why? How could one country just grab part of another independent nation and everybody just sort of looks the other way?
It just wasn't incredibly important at the time. I mean, I think quickly focus shifted elsewhere. This was also right around the time that ISIS became a major threat with its caliphate. And, you know, sanctions were imposed on Russia, the U.S. government and Europe sort of, you know, offered a high degree of criticism, but no one was willing to do anything that would overturn that process. And I think,
right,
you know, we still see it today. I mean, Russia is a major nuclear power, and the U.S. is willing to supply the Ukrainians, but there is significant reticence when it comes to true support that would kind of result in the Russians being kicked out of a place like Crimea. The U.S. won't put troops on the ground in Ukraine. Europeans, or even despite the rhetoric, are highly unlikely to do so, because the idea is that ultimately it could trigger a nuclear war, which is something that, you know, most people would want to avoid. And so it's a very kind of difficult situation where for the most part, and you see it in the book too, that the Russians also very quickly tried to find ways to force the U.S. back into talking with them after the annexation of Crimea. And so obviously that was a nadir at the time in U.S.-Russian relations. And a major motivating factor for the Russians intervening in Syria was because the Americans were already there fighting ISIS. And the idea for the Russians at the time was that we can force the Americans into a sort of joint counter ISIS operation. And I think they kind of misunderstood the Americans' willingness to do so. But there were still efforts kind of underway to maintain some contacts at the time. And again, it comes back to, you know, an idea of, you know, what could the U.S. truly do at the time about it? And it just the unfortunate fact that it wasn't important enough to merit the responses that we saw to the full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
Right, right. Now, are there mercenaries fighting for Ukraine?
It depends. I mean, defining mercenaries is always difficult. I would say that there are volunteers, certainly, from all over the place who are fighting on behalf of Ukraine. I don't actually know if they get paid or not, or get a salary. Maybe they do, but I think they are also there are plenty of volunteers, and I would say too that, I mean, especially when Wagner was fighting in say Ukraine, I mean, it's much closer to a volunteer force than a mercenary force. So in the Central African Republic, it's largely the host government, the Central Africans, who have hired Russians to fight for them. In Russia itself, the Russian state is the client, and these are Russian nationals. And so they function a lot more as all the other kind of private military groups. They function much more like alternative means of conscripting men to the front, sort of a volunteer contract force.
So the convicts that they recruited were offered basically their freedom and yes. their slate wiped clean for just 6 months of service.
Yes, granted you survive.
And they probably never mentioned how difficult it was going to be to survive, because those aren't very good odds if half of them died.
No, they did. That was what was so interesting in terms of I met and interviewed a number of the convicts who fought, and you go into these interviews, you know, kind of mentally prepared to talk about how they felt taken advantage of, and they did not. They felt, and you can see in the videos that are available where Prigozhin goes himself to these penal colonies, where he basically says, you know, my losses are greater than Stalingrad, which is something that would resonate with every Russian. That it's vicious, that not everyone is going to come back. And the convicts that I spoke to, at least at that time, maybe they began processing things a little bit more, kind of with more time under their belt, but they felt that it was a fair exchange.
Of course, the ones you talked to were the ones who survived.
Well, that there's obviously a filter, kind of a level of self-selection, but you have to kind of put yourself into the mentality also of who these guys are in the environment in which they live. Obviously, you know, we can talk about, you know, structural things like the fact that Russian prisons are now a cakewalk. I remember the two of the guys that I interviewed in the book, one of them had gone away for murder. He was sentenced to 20 years, and I think he had served like 5 or 6. And so the idea that he would sign up and take this chance, I guess, was somewhat understandable. But the guy next to him had gone away for assault and was sentenced to like 4 years. And I asked him, how many years have you served already? And he said 3. And so I was like, so you're saving 6 months? And he was like, yeah, you know, the most important thing, like one of them, they said, like, you know, the major takeaway, they're like, well, the most important thing is to not be a coward.
Oh, wow.
And so you could go into all sorts of, you know, imperiled masculinity in these prison environments, but it's a place that sort of spontaneous violence is rewarded. It's a place where it's important to be seen as brash.
Yeah. And, well, I hate to tell you, but yeah. U.S. prisons aren't that much different.
I think that people will find a lot of things that echo.
Yeah. True. Now, the convicts only got 2 weeks of training.
Yes.
Before they get thrown into the what you refer to as the meat grinder.
Yes.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, this was something, you know, they were adamant to say that the training was very good. But, I mean, it was still 2 weeks. But, you know, it was sort of this strange thing where it very much depended on the person, but kind of one of the big selling points was that, you know, once you're in Wagner, the stigma of being a convict no longer really applies. And so it's this very strange thing where they're used as basically cannon fodder. But the guys who survive have the ability then to join Wagner, not as part of the prisoner program and be essentially treated as equals. The ones who, you know, it's sort of a very kind of tragically Darwinian type of process, but the guys who survive those 6 months are actually very talented at that point at fighting in this kind of war. And so they go on to become commanders themselves. And so there was a degree on sort of an organizational level that Wagner was offering to treat these guys as equals and not as convicts. And again, we can refer, you know, in American society, it's no different. But in Russia, one of the main why this was so attractive is that there is such a stigma attached to being a convict in Russian society.
So it wasn't just getting out of prison, it was getting out with a clear record. And
I mean, it even referred back to, I mean, what was so, you know, what was so incredible too, and I allude to it in the book, is that there's a long history of using these penal units, and they were used in World War II as well. And it was sort of inevitable that the Russians would turn to this again. And the language was the same. Stalin approved the use of these penal units because it was an opportunity for those serving in them to atone for their sins with blood. And this was the exact language that was on the contracts for the Russian prisoners this time around, that this was also an opportunity for them to, I mean, I guess it was sort of a baptism again by fire, or, you know, a cleansing process as well, whereby they atone for their sins by shedding blood for the state and are able to return with a clean record, but also, I guess, kind of spiritually as well, in a bizarre way.
So, John, how did the Wagner Group get its name?
The commander that I alluded to, Dmitry Utkin, was a neo-Nazi and a big fan of Richard Wagner, the composer, and he used that as his call sign in 2014 in Donbass. And since he was number two, this eventually kind of applied to, became the catch-all term for the mercenary force. And it was sort of, you know, he was a neo-Nazi, Prigozhin was of Jewish descent. Neither of them found that to be particularly
problematic
problematic for working with each other, and there were, of course, a number of neo-Nazis and white nationalists in Wagner, but there were also a number of, you know, Muslims, there were a number of all, you know, all sorts of types who were working as well, and I mean, it kind of reflected too in a way. You have to think about, like, all societies have these guys, right, who are ex-military, have trouble adjusting to civilian life. They find themselves kind of sometimes on the wrong side of the law. And then, you know, they find that this PMC work is a fitting, you know, job for the skill sets that they have, that are not very great for civilian life. And sort of the Venn diagrams of those types of people who also, you know, people who love guns, people who love MMA fighting, people who are predisposed to white nationalism. I mean, the Venn diagrams tend to kind of overlap at certain points. And so there certainly were a lot of guys in there who kind of held those beliefs, but there were also a lot of people who did not.
Wow. So, when you were working on, you know, interviewing these people, you were going into some pretty dangerous places and meeting with some pretty dangerous people. Did you ever fear for your life?
I mean, there's this section in the book where I'm kidnapped and blindfolded, and that was certainly kind of an out-of-body experience in Mali. And I spent a lot of time, in places outside of any government's control and kind of next to these guys in Wagner. I would do everything I could to kind of mitigate those risks. I mean, it was undeniably risky, a lot of the things that I was doing. When I was in the countryside in the Central African Republic, which is, probably one of, I mean, it's like, State Department level, like super red, never go type of thing, because they can't help you out there. I would avoid talking to the Wagner guys out there in the bush, because I would talk to them in the capital in Bangui, but I would avoid. But there, there was also the issue that I also look kind of like a Wagner contractor too, in a way, especially when I'm out there. And so there's like a lot of kind of confusion. They would see me, and I mean, these are tiny villages in the bush in the Central African Republic, and so they see me. All the Central Africans think that I'm Russian, and so like it would cause there'd be like a lot of kind of like staring, but ultimately they didn't nothing happened to me out there. It helps too that I mean these are also I mean for folks who haven't been in war zones, I think one of the things that strikes you kind of right away is that there's actually like all of this infrastructure even in these war zones, and so number one of which is usually there's a ton of humanitarians who are working there, and so I would also kind of go and visit and be sponsored by humanitarian organizations, and so I was able also to I wasn't the only kind of non-local who was working there. There's so many other people who are working in these dangerous places and who aren't, writing books to be lauded about having gone there, and who do this work very quietly as well.
Do you find it exciting to be in that environment?
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
For
So
sure.
what are you working on next? What's your next topic?
Well, I'm hoping to do a book about kind of proxy forces more generally. Wagner, kind of as I explained in the book, is in a way a form of a proxy force, but I'd like to look at the use of proxies in warfare from the end of the Cold War to today. And so I think it would be really exciting to look again at what the US was doing in Central America in the 80s, and then bring us through the war on terror, and now sort of the great power competition as we're, potentially looking at future conflict with China, or Russia, which I think ultimately will probably play out much more through various proxies in various locations rather than a kind of a direct confrontation. And so I think readers I hope come away from in the book is that they realize that everyone has agency, and even the Central Africans in the poorest country in the world have a lot of agency in terms of how they deal with Wagner, and Wagner itself had a lot of agency vis-a-vis the Russian state, and it's the same with the Kurds. In Syria, when they work with the US, it's the same with these various governments in Central America as they're lobbying the US for support in the 80s. And so I think that'll be interesting to explore again.
Wow. Well, we'll look forward to that. Thank you so much for joining us today, John. And we've been speaking with John Lechner, author of Death is Our Business, Russian Mercenaries and the New Era of Private Warfare. For our closing quote, I'm going to read the quote you have at the top of chapter 4, which is from John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. It happens that every man in a bank hates what the bank does, and yet the bank does it. The bank is something more than men, I tell you. It's the monster. Men made it, but they can't control it. Thank you.
And thank you so much.
See you all next week on Writers' Voices. Mm-hmm.